18. Carnival in Berlin is, like so many of the city's customs, a somewhat artificial, stage-managed affair. There are no droll rituals, sanctified by long usage, as there are in the Catholic areas of Germany. It does not have the spontaneous, warm-heartedness that carries one along in the Munich Carnival. Its major characteristics are the very Berlinish ones of bustle and organization. A carnival ball in Berlin is like a large, colourful, well-organized love raffle, with winning tickets and duds. You take your chance, join up with a girl, kiss and cuddle her, and go through all the preparatory stages of a love affair in a single night. The usual end is a taxi drive at daybreak and the exchange of phone numbers. By then you usually know whether it is the start of something that you would like to take further, or whether you have just earned yourself a hangover. It all takes place in a wild, garish environment, the bustle, with the clashing noise of several dance bands, in a building decorated with coloured paper chains and lanterns, accompanied by as much alcohol as you can afford. You are packed in like sardines, with several thousand other young couples all doing the same thing, not bothering about anyone else. The ball I went to was for some reason called Dachkahn, Roof Punt, and was organised by an art academy. It was big, loud, colourful and full, like all Berlin carnival balls. It took place on February the 25th, a Saturday. I arrived fairly late and it was already in full swing, a teeming crowd, glimpses of silk, naked shoulders and female legs, a crush in which one could hardly move, the cloakrooms full, no room at the bars. The crush was part of the obligatory bustle. I found it difficult to get into the mood. On the contrary, I arrived feeling rather depressed. I had had some worrying news that afternoon. The election campaign was not going the way the Nazis wanted. They were planning a coup, with massive arrests and a regime of terror. We should be prepared for the worst in the next few weeks. It made me uneasy, but of course it was still only a matter for the press. This was the true reality, wasn't it? The overheard scraps of conversation, laughter, music, and freely given smiles. I stood there on a step, distracted and undecided, watching the revellers around me, the hot, shiny, glowing, eager, smiling faces, so many, so innocent, all just hoping to meet a nice boyfriend or girlfriend for a night, or a season, a whiff of the sweetness of life, a little adventure, something to be fondly remembered. All at once I had a strange, dizzy feeling. I felt as though I were inescapably imprisoned with all these young people in a giant ship that was rolling and pitching. We were dancing on its lowest, narrowest deck, while on the bridge it was being decided to flood that deck and drown every last one of us. An arm pushed itself through mine from behind. I recognized a familiar voice and surfaced back to reality, if that was what it was. It was an old acquaintance from happy tennis club days, a girl called Liesel, whom I had lost sight of for some time, almost forgotten. Now she stood there, comforting and friendly, ready for some fun. She interposed herself firmly between me and my black thoughts. Her small, solid body screened out the world and the Nazis, and brought me back to the path of carnival duty. Within an hour I had been found a partner. I had my raffle prize, a small, black-haired girl in a Turkish page-boy's costume, very dainty to look at, with large brown eyes. At first glance, she resembled the actress Elisabeth Berkner. That was her intention. Many Berlin girls wanted to look like Elisabeth Berkner at that time. One could not ask for better. Liesel gave me a wink and disappeared into the throng, and Miss Bergner became my girlfriend for the night, and not just for that night, but for a whole desolate period to come. It was not to be an entirely happy friendship, but I did not know that yet. She was light as a feather, lay easily in my arms when we danced, spoke precociously in a small, high-pitched voice, making cheeky little jokes with a certain brittle, dry Berlin charm. As she did so, her large eyes, so much older than her face, lit up. She was very attractive, and I was satisfied with my prize. We danced a while and then had some drinks. After that, we strolled about a bit and came to a small room where the music could be heard only faintly from a distance. We settled down and tried to guess each other's names. After a little while we gave up and decided to invent new ones. She called me Peter. I called her Charlie. Good names for lovers in a Vicky Baum novel. You could not ask for better. In giving ourselves these names, we were preparing to become a pair of lovers à la mode. The few other couples on either side of us were occupied only with themselves. They did not bother us. However, an elderly actor, commanding and lonely as he stood in the centre of the room, gave us his whimsical blessing, calling us his children and ordering cocktails for all of us. It was almost like a little family. After a while, I felt like dancing again. I had promised Liesel to look her up later, but events took a different turn. I do not know how the rumour first spread that the police were in the building. From time to time, people had come into the room and tipsily tried to attract our attention by cracking more or less successful jokes as well as they could. Someone may have shouted, "Get up, the police are here." I did not think that was a particularly good joke. Then the rumour intensified. A few girls started to become nervous, then jumped up and left, followed by their cavaliers. Suddenly there was a young man, dressed completely in black, with black hair and black eyes, in the middle of the room. He declared in a fierce, rough voice that we would all do well to get out, unless we wanted to spend the night at Alexanderplatz. That was where the police headquarters were, and the cells. He behaved rather as if he were a policeman himself, but on closer inspection I remembered that he had been in the room, kissing a girl, for quite a while. The girl had disappeared. Now I noticed that he was wearing a badge on his cap that represented the fasces bundle of a Roman lictor. And my God, his black costume was a fascist uniform. Strange costume. Strange behaviour. The old actor rose from his chair and, swaying a little, left the room. It felt like a dream. Somewhere, in one of the rooms that gave ours its dim illumination, the lights went out. There were loud screams. All of a sudden we all looked pale as ghosts. It made a very theatrical effect. "Is it true about the police?" I asked the black-clad young man. "It is true, my son," he bawled out. "But why? What's up?" "Work it out for yourself. There are people who don't like this sort of thing," he said, and he slapped a nearby girl loudly on her naked thigh. I was not quite sure whether he was on the side of the police or whether this was some kind of wild gesture of defiance. I shrugged. "Let's see for ourselves, eh, Charlie?" She nodded and followed me trustingly. There was tumult everywhere, turmoil, unease, and an edge of panic. Something was definitely up. Perhaps something unpleasant had happened, maybe an accident or a fight. Could it be that even here some people had shot at one another, Nazis or communists? It did not seem altogether impossible. We pushed our way through several rooms. There. The police really were there, in their helmets and their blue uniforms. They stood there amid the turbulent flow of alarmed, brightly costumed figures, like rocks in the breaking waves. Now we would find out. I approached one of them, a little deprecatingly, smiling and confident, as one approaches a policeman to ask for directions. "Do we really have to leave?" "You have permission to leave," was the reply. And I flinched, so threateningly had it been said. Slowly, icily, and maliciously, I looked at him, and flinched again. What kind of face was that? Not the usual, familiar, friendly, honest face of an ordinary policeman. This face seemed to consist entirely of teeth. The man had literally snarled at me, baring both rows of teeth, an unusual grimace for a human being. His teeth showed small, pointed, and evil, like a shark's. The whole pale, blonde face was fish-like and shark-like under the helmet, with watery, colourless eyes and a pike's pointed nose above the teeth. Very Nordic, one had to admit, but then again not really human. Rather more like the face of a crocodile. I shuddered. I had seen the face of the SS.